Well, we've had a coffee break, and now we're back. And it was 1953, and you had got your first job. And can you go through the next few years? And I know you became a judge, but what kind of law did you specialize in?
I don't think I really specialized in anything. In a small law firm, you did what came along. And I had expected that I would probably do a lot of, conveyancing, estates, and that sort of solicitor's work. But a case came along that the firm had, and one of the partners had to give evidence in it because it had to do with a negotiation of a contract. So, who was to act for the client in court? Me. It was 1954. So I did. We lost that case, but didn't take long before, much to my surprise, I discovered I was, to other people too, that I was good at counsel work. And I worked very hard at it, and we had lots of interesting stuff in that firm. Union disputes, management, lots of strikes, picketing issues. And that was before the Labor Relations Board, the whole reform of labor law in British Columbia, which basically put all this stuff in the hands of the Labor Relations Board. Well, there were lots of lawsuits. Lawyers suing unions. And then in 1958, I left that firm and I went into partnership with Graham Ladner. And I stayed with him until 1966. Then I decided it was time to see some more of the world, so decided I'd go around the world. So I did. Took the Trans-Siberian Railway. But you don't know very many people who traveled the Trans-Siberian Railway.
One.
Now two.
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 Yep.
And that was a very interesting trip in 66. And then I came back and practiced in association with my old firm. But I was sort of independent on my own, and it suited me better. The arrangement seemed to have suited everybody. That continued until 1985. When I was put on bench. Of course, in the interim, I'd been treasurer of the Law Society and things like that, A couple of unsuccessful tries at getting elected to Parliament.
I found one of them in the internet, 1965.
Yeah, it's Vancouver South.
Art Lang.
Yeah.
Norm Levy were both ahead of you, but not by that much.
Oh, well, there was not a conservative year, and in retrospect, I was very lucky not to get elected. Because I think, particularly now, what kind of a life is there being a member of Parliament? There are trains, nothing but train seals on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
When I was reading Harold Millen's memoirs, thinking how very different the House of Commons works over there. Maybe it's not quite like that now, but there might be whole groups of conservative MPs, even when the conservatives were in office, who were taking opposition, opposing things that the government was proposing. And putting out their old position papers on things and just having a different view from whatever the accepted government position was, and nobody seemed to think that disqualified them from calling themselves conservatives.
So the British system was more inclusive of dissent within a
I think it always had been. I think what happened in Canada, I don't know exactly what happened in Canada that caused us to develop this trade seal mentality. Something.
I don't understand either. There's certainly a lot of criticism of Stephen Harper now for keeping his party and his MPs in line.
Mm-hmm. They shouldn't have to be kept in line. I mean, it shouldn't be a question of that. I mean, there can be votes of confidence, and then, I mean, they have them in England too, and then the whips get on to the members, and if you want to stay, you have to vote on this one for the government. But everything's not a matter of confidence, and it shouldn't be. And, of course, maybe it may be a reflection of the fact that we really don't have, say, in Harper's case, I know he's got a majority of the seats, but he hasn't got a majority of the electorate. Has he? We haven't had a government elected with a majority in the electorate since probably the Diefenbaker sweep of 58. The French do it better. I hate to admit that, but I think their electoral system is better than ours. We should have an election on one Sunday, and then if nobody gets a majority of the votes in the constituency, a runoff next week between the two tops. Then we'd have a better idea, then the members would better reflect the country than they do now. This present situation is hardly what you'd call democratic. However, we're way off the topic of what you came here to talk about.
Well, politics is a big thing. We'll be talking to Mike Harcourt tomorrow. Mm-hmm. We're also going to talk to Sven Robinson.
Oh,
where,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot of politicians who've been through this law school.
Yeah.
So you, 1965, you were in the you ran, and then 66, you went on your on your grand tour.
My grand tour, yep.
And when I looked you up on the internet, and there's a lot of firsts associated with you as a woman, okay. First woman elected as a bencher of a law society in 1971. But how do you feel about the firsts? Did you do it
No.
Mary Southern, or as a woman? I mean, were you...
Or I hope I did it as me.
Mm-hmm.
Me. I mean, I don't think... I don't know what I would have thought about the women voting if I had been born in 1860 instead of 1931. Isn't there one of those Oscar Wilde plays where somebody, when this issue of the franchise is coming up, the woman says something to me, "Oh, I don't want to be the vote. It keeps them all busy. Keep the men in the meeting, the men keeps them all busy." And, you know, maybe I would have thought that. You can't put yourself back in time. And it's in a very unfortunate, I think, now when people are inclined to judge people's attitudes by today rather than by the world in which they lived. Like the business about the Indian schools. Probably they weren't any worse than a lot of English boys' boarding schools.
That is exactly what my parents say.
Yes, not
who,
any
who
worse.
Went through them.
Yes. Or, you know, isn't it one of Dickens' Mr. Gradgrind? If they won't learn, they must be made to learn. Which meant, of course, a few strokes of the cane, didn't it? You know, and that's what people... The judgments that are made, say, about those who set up the schools in the 1900s, a lot of it would have been done by people who'd been through the English boarding school system.
To them, this was a viable institution.
That's right. I mean, I don't think boarding schools are a I never thought that they were a great idea. I would never have wanted to go to one myself. But I know lots of people who did. So, but I think it's cruel to judge people by today's standards. I think it's unjust.
Historians have a word for it. They call it presentism. To apply the values of the present to people in the past.
Yeah.
And you do have to learn the context.
Yes.
That people of people's lives in the past.
I think so too.
Which is the challenge of doing history.
Yes.
And in a sense of the historian, even in a situation like this, to allow the past you to, you know, to explain how things worked, how things were different. Change is the only thing permanent.
That's right. And that's what people think, that that's not so. Everything's always in a state of flux. Which philosopher said that? You know, somebody.
Change is the only thing permanent. A Greek.
McLuhan said the changes.
Well, and some Greek said it. I forgot which Greek it was, but it is true. So all those things you say they were first, well, they were true, but I didn't do it all on my own, you know. I didn't do any of it, all of this on my own. I mean, I wouldn't have been able to do any of it if my family hadn't come here, if my mother hadn't had to struggle, had to do what she did to get a first-rate education. And my mother was a highly intelligent woman, and she passed on as much as she could of what she knew to her husband. He couldn't have become a professional engineer, I don't think. You know, and all those things. You don't do any of it on your own. And anybody who thinks he or she did it on his or her own is suffering from some kind of a swelled head. It's terrible. It's crazy. And look how lucky anybody was to have been born here in 1931 and not in London, England. Why, my sister and I used to laugh. We were even lucky, going far enough back, part of our family were French Huguenots and were kicked out of France with the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. And weren't we lucky? We were lucky to be kicked out. We were lucky that they were kicked out.
Well, my mom was born in England in 1931 and was evacuated to the country when Oxford was...
39-40, yes.
Yep, and it was a pretty traumatic time.
Oh, I think it was dreadful for the children and dreadful for their, you know, and... It really is, and you wonder about it. And then, of course, there were the children who were sent out here to get away. And then there was that terrible business of the ship, I can't think of its name now, that was carrying a lot of children to come out where the Germans sank it off the English coast.
The city of Benares.
The city of Benares, yeah.
My dad was on the convoy right before that.
Oh.
And came to Vernon to the he was evacuated. He was an evacuee, they were called. And when the city of Benares was sunk, they stopped
doing
sending kids here.
Yeah.
Yep.
It was a terrible thing to have done. But then war does terrible things. And people talk about here, the question of what happened to the Japanese. Well, I never thought that it was wrong to remove them from the coast. What was wrong was that a lot of people made a lot of money out of this disposition of Japanese property. And that was terrible. But now, do you study criminal law out there still? The university?
Still a little bit of criminal law every now and again.
Well, you should look up sometime, because I think it's a very interesting comment on that whole problem of the Japanese here. There's a murder case called The King and Hughes. In about 1941 or early 42, down in what we call Japtown. there was a Japanese family, had a, before they were moved away, had a shop. And these three, Hughes was one of them, soldiers, went in there with a gun. And in a fight with the son of the family, the boy was killed. They were charged with murder. And at the trial, Alfred Bull was counsel for the Crown. And what he said in effect was that they are here within the protection of the Crown, referring to the Japanese family, and you should do the right thing. And the right thing was convict them of murder, which the jury proceeded to do, and it was after the fall of Hong Kong. Now that's, you know, then when the thing finally went to the Supreme Court of Canada, Chief Justice Duff, I don't know if he was Chief Justice then, he wrote some kind of a judgment to get these guys out of being convicted, out of being hanged. I think he managed to convict them of manslaughter or something crazy. But you can, you know, there you can ask yourself, by then, maybe, and one of those, Hughes himself was in the army, that how would the country have taken it, if we had hanged a serving Canadian soldier for killing a Jap in 1942? You think of the political implications of it, but it's a disgraceful case just the same. The whole thing was a disgrace from beginning to end.
So it was politicized, could you say?
Oh heavens, yes. Not by Crown Counsel at the trial, and not by the jury. But it became so. But I'm moving them away from the coast. I can't see that was wrong. Because nobody knew to what extent, if at all, some of the Japanese fishermen were in fact plants by the Japanese Navy. There was no reason why they shouldn't have. I mean, people do that all the time, don't they? They put spies under cover for years. Well, they used to. I don't suppose they do anymore.
Well, it's a good example of the need for historical context.
Well, I think so. Yes. It's easy to say, looking back, oh, what a terrible way to behave. All British Columbians were horrid people. Well, there was a war on, you know. And we were all handed out dog tags, you know. I think I was 11 or 12 when the thing was getting worse. The idea being that it was made quite clear that if we got bombed or blown up and they found a dog tag with no child attached, well, the child was dead, and that you'd know what child had been killed. Well, I mean, nothing happened. The closest the Japanese got was a Japanese submarine that shelled Estevan Point in 1942. But nobody knew that. I mean, that's as it turned out. But we feared the worst here. We had blackouts. So as a little kid, you think, well, I think I was glad to go to Montreal. It was a long way from the Japanese.
It was an emergency. As you say, it was a war.
Yeah.
War on.
Yep. Yeah. Anyway, that's so you add, so back to the point about first. No. Nobody gets to be first at anything without an awful lot of help from other people. It's just... That's what I think, anyway. And anybody who says I did it all myself is arrogant in the extreme.
And did you have the support of your colleagues and profession? They didn't stand in the way?
I never felt anybody stood in anything. No, everybody was fine. I never had any reason to complain about. Well, I shouldn't say. I mean, occasionally you'd meet somebody who was older who tried to push you around a little bit, but I'd never let that bother. I mean, the judges were fine. They were fine.
What's the process of becoming a judge?
Well, in my day, I was lucky. I mean, why did I get put in the bench? Well, I was a respectable enough lawyer, but I had my conservative connections, didn't I?
Yep.
Well, I'm sure they helped. I had nothing to do with it, but I'm sure they helped. I'm sure somebody in Ottawa said, well, we need to appoint a new judge. It probably would be a good idea if we appoint a woman, since everybody's pushing to have women on the bench. So, what about Mary Southern? After all, she stood for us twice for Parliament and all that sort of thing. That would be an okay. That'll do it.
What year was that?
1985. There was none of this applying or any of that rubbish. Thank goodness. I mean, that's how judges got appointed back then. It helped to have the right political connections.
And did they have to, did they kind of check you out and make sure you didn't have a kind of eccentric track record and that sort of thing?
I don't know what they did, if anything. I don't suppose they did anything.
If you're going to be a judge for life, practically, or for a good long time.
Well, I think the place was small enough that I think people figured they knew who everybody was. Everybody knew who everybody was, and everybody knew what everybody's reputation was. I don't think anybody went around snooping.
What about judgments? What's the process there? Do you do lots of research, or?
You just sit down with a piece of paper in front of you and a pen in hand and start in. You know, everybody's got his or her own style, but I think a judge's writing style is partly developed from all the judgments you've already read. Other people's. You try to make it plain what you're dealing with, what the issues are, and what your opinion is. If the Court of Appeal doesn't like it, well, too bad. And I never worried about whether the Court of Appeal was going to like it or not. I just did the best I could. I think that's what most people... I think there are some judges who always have an eye on the Court of Appeal and try to write a judgment that is unappealable. Well, I never tried that.
What are some of the what were some of the highlights of your judgments that you remember?
Well, I suppose the most interesting case of its kind was what was known as the Richards and Greenshields case, which was a big stock fraud committed by some chaps out here. On an American investment house in, I think they were in Texas. And, I don't remember the name of it now, but it was a cause célèbre of its kind. The trial lasted for ages. Well, a month, that seemed like ages at the time. Doesn't seem like anything now. So there were interesting things, but most of the stuff we know is pretty run-of-the-mill. Who went through the stop sign, you know.
So. You mentioned that cases take longer now. Is that because of the Constitution Act?
I think there are a lot of factors. That's one of them. When it comes to criminal cases, I think that's the charter. You know, when I started out, all evidence was admissible, even if it had been illegally obtained. And the only thing that couldn't be put in evidence in a criminal case, if it were illegally obtained, was a confession. So there weren't these unending charter arguments and unending applications for documents and whatnot that are just a mock. Most of it's just a mockery and of justice. Maybe legal, but it's a mockery of justice. because of the cost. You look at the Bert Beese thing. Look at that. Look at what that's cost the public.
Is that still going on?
No. They finally pleaded guilty. I mean, that really is a terrible. And but it's all coming out of the public purse, so why does anybody care? The public's going to pay for it instead of the client. Harry Bray, who was a senior member of the bar when I was first called, but he had a reputation for saying to his clients they're going to have a lawsuit. This was in the days when money was worth something. Do you want a $500 lawsuit or a $5,000 lawsuit? Well, no stone unturned, or only turning up the stones under which there may be something. It's no wonder ordinary people can't afford litigation.
Is this the role of legal aid important here?
Is it contributing to things being longer than they should be? Well, I don't know. The Vert Beese thing, of course, was not legal aid. That was because of some provision about civil servants charged with offenses. So I can't say about that, but it's possible. I don't know. See, when I started out, there was no legal aid. There wasn't any. One got roped into doing some occasionally. I mean, I did some because a very nice woman who was the head of the St. James Legal, St. James Social Service thing. Her name escapes me for the moment, it shouldn't, but every once in a while she'd phone me up and want me to defend somebody from the north who was picked up in the downtown east side. You know. So you did.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't get paid, so what? And most lawyers did, you know, some stuff for people inexpensively or not for nothing, because that was part of the canon of legal ethics at the time. I don't know whether it still is, but certainly was for us.
That whole pro bono.
Oh yeah, well that's a horrible American expression.
Is it?
Yes. Yes. No. We never used that. Just said I'm doing it for nothing. You know, and you just expected to do some work for nothing.
We've been asking the people we interview what the greatest change changes they've seen over their career.
Well, it's hard to really put that in words, but I do think lawyers have become excessively long-winded. Long-winded. And nobody wants to get to the end of anything. You know, you could think, the enormous change has been on the criminal side with the charter. If you were appealed a criminal conviction when I first started out, somebody on the Court of Appeal would say to you, did the accused give evidence? And if you said no, you've got to look on their faces and sort of, that closed that down. You know, you had to have an awfully good point of law to overcome your client not having given evidence. Because the theory was, if the Crown had a case and it was not answered, then, well, that's that, isn't it? This case called King and Jenkins, about 19, I don't know, 20 or 10 maybe, even earlier, based on an English theory, Now the theory is that you even tell a jury that they're not supposed to even take into consideration whether there's been any answer given. That's silly. But so that, but the charter has made an enormous difference. Now, it certainly, some things about it are good things, but other things are just costing the public a fortune. Look at all these drug cases. They're nothing but charter arguments, aren't they, nowadays? If you haven't got a charter argument, you haven't got a defense. So that's, I think, made a big difference to the law. And I'm sure there are other things that have too, but that's what I think has done it. Enormous difference.
I suppose another thing is the electronic, the internet. And do you have email, or are you still on the...
Don't know how either.
No.
The younger members of the family are trying to persuade me to learn how. One of them came over last week, my nephew, great-nephew he is actually, with a new tablet, you know, and I... He said, yeah, it's really easy. Now just sit down here. So he pushed, you know, he said, this is what... I said, Chris, it'll take more than 10 minutes. It took more than 10 minutes for me to teach you how to have proper manners and be a gentleman. So do you think you could teach me to do this?
Well, the young people, my kids who are 16, 14, 18, it's second nature to them.
Oh, I know it is. I know it is. The way that the young people do it, I think it's really quite remarkable. Although whether the... And able, so many things that you can find out once you know how to do it properly, they're interesting to know and maybe very useful to know. But when I read about all the emails that are sent back and forth between one of my nieces and her son and grandchildren on the prairies, and I think, really, what's the use of all that? What's the use of being inundated with pictures of the grandchildren when you're going to see them at Christmas? You know? But...
Well, one thing that's I've found about these interviews is that they're almost a return to an old-fashioned form of communication called conversation. Because
yes,
we don't...
conversation, yes.
Because we're going to go... Graham and I are going to go... later to our email account. I have two of them, one for law and one for home, and it's absolutely remorseless.
That's
and
what people
the
tell
pace,
me.
It's so fast.
That's what I'm told, that people are inundated with stuff. And one of the loveliest things about becoming a judge was that the phone never rang. And I shouldn't say never, of course, occasionally my sister might phone me or something like that, but unlike when I was practicing, the phone was irritating. It interfered with one's thinking. You know, thinking is very important. And I don't know whether all this stuff helps people to think. From what my nieces tell me, that they get inundated with emails that are of no consequence whatever. Just stuff that they have to go through to make sure that there isn't, that it's not. One of them is an administrator out at one of at the University of the Fraser Valley, and drives her crazy. So what's the good of all that? What's the good of all that?
No, it's a tyranny, I think.
I think so. Why is it that we can't have a new invention that's very useful in some ways without misusing it? You know, there have been good inventions and they end up getting overused and misused. The telephone itself, I thought was overused. Cell phones. Now, when they came on, I thought a cell phone would have been a very nice thing to have had, assuming it worked, when I was traveling in Russia by myself. Not for my sake, but being able to phone home and tell my family I'm fine, because they had no idea for 6 weeks whether I was dead or alive. The mail was very slow. So it would have been nice, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And when I drove across Canada once by myself, I used to think, well, I hope nothing goes wrong, because here I am out in the middle of Saskatchewan. And, you know, cars weren't so efficient. So from that point of view, a cell phone, I think, is a wonderful invention. And also, it's enough to drive you bats when you walk down the street and all you can hear are people blithering away on their cell phones. Sometimes I think it should be banned, but I don't want to ban anything that just lets the city council get in the way and start pushing people around. So,
the other thing we've been asking is who else can we talk to, or should we? Who can you recommend?
Well, you sound amazed if you talk to almost everybody that's worth talking to. You talk to Jane Banfield, Marvin Storrow, and Joan Peacock, Cave Brown Cave.
Oh, well, we've got here
Pat Proudfoot.
Actually, here is the class of a list of the class of 52. And maybe you'll see someone else who's
still alive. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many. Did you ever count up how many of us there were altogether?
No, but these are the graduates. I think these are the ones who.
Yeah. A lot of these people are gone. Alan McDonnell, Sam Levis. Bob Reiki. John Steves.
Was he related to this, the Dorothy Steves? The
I don't believe so, no. Some of these names aren't quite right, though. John Drysdale, not D-D-Y, D-R-Y. Bill Beckingham just died a couple weeks ago.
Was he Port Alberni?
He was Port Alberni. He just died.
Yeah. Well, that's too bad.
About three weeks ago.
I knew his son, or know his son.
And yet the lawyer, the younger.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What's his name? Forgotten.
And it was Gordon Cheesby. It's B-S-H-E-A-S-B-E-Y. A lot of these people went off somewhere else. I'm sure Air Commodore Hull is dead, because he was the man 50 plus or more when I was at law school.
Do you have a class reunion?
Well, we had a class reunion years ago. I didn't go. Shocking as well. No, most of them are dead. Ted Hinkson's gone. Pat Hogan. Yep. So I really can't think of.
Nope.
I don't know what happened to Harvey Bowering. It's not Harold. His name was Harvey.
Was he related? Do you know? There's two literary Bowerings. There's George and Marilyn.
I don't think he was. I don't know, but I don't think so. But as far as I know, Peter Manson is still around.
And I was going to ask, is that one of the Manson, the
No.
Attorney General?
No, he was not one of those Mattsons. There was a Mattson. Alec Mattson, the judge, did have a son, but Peter was not it. I don't know whether they were... They may have been related, but he may still be around. I mean, when I say that, it seems to me about a year ago, I saw him and his wife riding their bicycles up here. But I haven't... I haven't seen him lately, but I'm sure you can find out. So I'm afraid you're getting near the end of the road. Of course, you see, most of these people were quite a bit older than I am.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Since I was the baby of the class by far.
We talked to Harry Bell Irving, I told you, who was in the class of 49.
Mm-hmm.
And he thinks there's only one or two left, and the 48 class might be gone.
Yeah.
And he was younger.
Yeah. Well, the Bell Irvings have had a reputation, I think, for being long-lived.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Well,
isn't he the son of the lieutenant governor?
No, I think that was a cousin.
Oh.
He's the son of an engineer.
Oh.
Who worked at the Powell River Company. Oh. And he had three older brothers, mm-hmm. who are all gone.
Mm-hmm. Well, sorry I can't help you, but...
That's okay. If you think of someone, you can let me know. I give you my card with the phone number on it.
I don't know what happened to Joan Hagman. She's not Joan Hagman anymore. I know that. He was not a nice man, her husband, and she got rid of him quite right, too. Unless none of us liked him when she married him, so... Didn't like him. Hmm. Bill Gill, who won the gold medal in our year, I believe he's gone. He went back to Calgary or Edmonton. So there you are.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know about Dolores Branca. Her married name is Holmes. And I'm sure she's still with us. I have no reason to think she's not.
Pat Proudfoot, I think, mentioned her.
Yeah. Well, they were great friends, and I don't know, of course, as the years go by, often people's friendships wither, not for any reason, it's just that time and circumstance makes things different. Yeah.
She would be good to talk to as well because of her
Her
dad.
Because of her father. Of all these people, I would say she'd be the best choice.
Okay.
Because of that. And because, you know, Angelo was such a presence in the legal profession in British Columbia in his time. Such a presence. And on the Court of Appeal, too. And as a presence in the Italian community. He was very important in the Italian community. So that's just the way things are. So I would think that would be a good choice.
Okay, well, we'll look them up.
Yeah, if you can find, as I say, I can't think what her husband's Christian names are. All I know is her married name is Holmes.
Well, we can ask the
never mind, just any old thing will do.
Yeah. Well, do you think we should make tracks, Graham.
Sure. All right, there you are.
Well,
I hope you... Now you just put everything back together again.
Of course.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much.